And today for our next It From Qubit virtual seminar, we are very happy to have our own It From Qubit fellow from Caltech, Arant Garibian, who will be telling us about Python's Lunch, Geometric Obstructions to Decoding Hawking Radiation. And let me just make a couple comments. Everyone is welcome to either turn their video on or leave it off as they prefer, but please leave your microphone muted. Unless you want to ask a question, and then you should just go ahead and unmute and interrupt the speaker. And if you want, you can turn your video on so the speaker can see you while you're asking your question. And finally, let me just remind everyone that they're welcome to send me nominations or suggestions for future speakers in this series. And with that, I'll stop talking and let Arant take it away.
Hello, everybody. Yeah, thank you for this opportunity to talk about work I completed with some excellent collaborators back in December. The title is Python's Lunch. I hope by the end of the talk it will be clear what we mean by this term. But to give you in a language that it's more obvious, it's basically geometric interpretation to the complexity of decoding Hawking radiation and what are the geometric obstructions to making this decoding easy. And so as I said, this is a work with Adam Brown, myself, Jeff Pennington, and Lenny Susskind from December. The archive number is here, and I'm It From Qubit fellow currently working at Caltech with John Preskill's group. Okay, let's get started. So, okay, let's go to 2013 and talk about the paper by Harlow and Hayden about decoding information from a Hawking radiation. In this paper, Harlow and Hayden argued that decoding is exponentially complex. What I mean by that, if you wait a little after the page time for the black hole to evaporate, then if you try to decode the information about what fell into the black hole, it will be in the radiation after the page time, based on some information theoretic argument. However, in this paper, Harlow and Hayden argue that actually accessing this information is exponentially complex. At the time, they were thinking about giving a possible practical argument for the resolving firewall paradox. But their argument mainly relies on two aspects of the black hole and radiation. First is that the radiation is mixed with the degrees of freedom of the black hole right before it's emitted. It's like mixed, it's evolving together in some complicated evolution. And the other was some complexity class reduction. So more specifically, they argue that like if it was possible to decode easily, it will result in some large complexity class reducing to a smaller one, which is unlikely to happen. So in the space of complexity theory, this is in a level of mathematical proof. A similar argument like a year after was proposed by Aronson based on that if you were able to decode Hawking radiation easily, he argued that you could invert one-way functions, arbitrary one-way functions, which is highly unlikely that you will be able to do it. And also more recently, Preskill and Isaac Kim and Eugene Tang argued that in fact, if you are only allowed to act with the polynomial number in S operations on a radiation, you cannot really tell the difference of this radiation compared to the thermal state. And you know, this is known if you can't, it's essentially a pseudo-random state, the state of the radiation, which means practically it is a thermal state. So this is just a line of thinking that has developed for a while about why decoding information from radiation should be difficult. Parallel to this, there was a developments by Lenny Susskind, Adam, and their collaborators starting 2014 and like in later years about thinking about what's the dual of the length or actually volume of the wormhole. So, okay, let's start with the Penrose diagram of a two-sided black hole and evolve the state that's thermal field double at 0, 0 time on left and right at some fixed time, this would be the state. And the Einstein-Rosen bridge here, like, is denoted by the blue line that connects left and right. And Lenny and Douglas Stanford argued that this complexity of the state, meaning that minimal number of gates that you can create this state from a very simple state on the Hilbert space, will be related to the volume of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. Later on, this was actually like generalized to not just beyond volume, but relating the complexity to the action. And they studied various examples in these papers where they show the connection between the complexity and the action. So what motivated us to think about the Python's launch and the geometric abstractions is like this apparent contradiction because between these two lines of thinking. In one way, if you have an evaporating black hole that like evaporates a little after page time, which will be some polynomial time of S, which is the initial entropy of the black hole, the space-time volume or like any notion of action you can think of will be polynomial in S. There's no way it would be exponential. However, the complexity argument from Harlow Hayden and others like suggested that it should be exponential to decode, the complexity should be exponential to decode these messages. So we were like kind of intrigued by this apparent contradiction, and we started thinking a bit deeper what's happening. And that would be my goal, to explain the difference and the connection between geometric objects and the complexity. Maybe I should like pause and see if anybody has any questions. I would rather have it more interactive. So any questions at this point? All right.
Actually, I have a question.
Perfect. Okay. Super.
Yeah, so you're saying there's apparent contradiction, but I mean, at the same time, it looks like they're talking about different scenarios, right? I mean, this is complexity of a state, the whole geometry, and the other one is just specifically talking about the Hawking radiation. So from the point of view.
That's right. Good. So this is basically exactly what's happening, but there's more than that, right? We're talking like there are two notions of gate complexity, unitary complexity, but that's right. There are different notions. And actually, this exactly brings me to the clarification of these two notions of complexity. So, good. You kind of prepared the question for the next slide. So the exact difference between the notion of complexity these two papers talk about is following. Like one notion, there's some subtle differences regarding like state complexity versus the unitary gate complexity. But up to that subtlety, the big difference between the two is following. Suppose you start with the maximally entangled state between A and B that's like composed of tensor product of Bell pairs. Let's call it phi plus A and B. You know, it could be S pairs on one side and S pairs on the other. And then you evolve with some unitary that acts on the joint system. And it's some kind of a mixing unitary such that in the end of this dynamics, the state is also maximally mixed between A and B. Then you could actually reproduce the action of approximately, like this is approximate statement of UAB on A and B only by acting on a single site. And then you can have two notions of complexity. One that we call unrestricted complexity. That is the notion of complexity that allows you to build the unitary AB using gates that act on entire system A and B. So you can have gates that couple qubits in A, qubits in B, and then can go across A and B. And the other notion is restricted complexity, where you only allow gates acting on one of the subsystems. Like typically it would be one that's slightly larger than the other, so all of the information will be in the larger system. So what we are saying is that what Harlow and Hayden are talking about is about restricted complexity. Essentially the gates you need to act on radiation alone. But Lenny and collaborators think about unrestricted complexity that allows gates that can like couple entire like black hole and radiation system. Okay. Good. So more specifically, in terms of like the gates that make up this state, like in one case, the restricted complexity of Harrow-Hayden will be this gate set that acts only on a system. And they can actually be, these two notions of complexity can be equal or can be very different. So in the evaporating Bragg hole, it's actually, the point is that these two are very different. So, okay, let's start from a case when they are actually similar. These two definitions of complexity would be the same, is if you start with a thermofield double state, like the input state here, and evolve it with the Hamiltonians that are not coupling left and right. So independent Hamiltonian on left, independent Hamiltonian on right, and then evolve it. Then the restricted and unrestricted complexity of the states would be the same, meaning that the number of gates that I would need to make the state from by acting on both sides versus on a single side will be the same. And this comes from the fact that the dynamics does not really couple left and right. So like to undo this by gates, to reproduce this by gates, we don't really need any gates going across from left to the right. So this is a case when the restricted and unrestricted could be both polynomial if the time evolution went for a polynomial amount, for a polynomial length of time. So the case of evaporating black hole is very different, because at each time, okay, so let's look at the naive Penrose diagram that, you know, we create a pure state black hole with some infalling shell. And then we have blue denotes the horizon here. And then we have Hawking modes at each time step going out. And then after the Hawking mode came out of the black hole, it doesn't talk to the black hole degrees of freedom. But before it was emitted, it was mixing with the rest of the modes. So in fact, the dynamics of the Hawking radiation and the black hole, if you think of it as a quantum circuit, it actually couples the radiation to the black hole up to some point until that specific mode came out, and so on. So in fact, it would be like a gate, and this is exactly why it can have complexity that's exponentially large, a restricted complexity versus the unrestricted complexity can be polynomial in the entropy. So, okay, this is like a simple way to say, resolve the contradiction, but I guess like we were trying to understand it a bit further, meaning that is there anything about the geometry of evaporating black hole, the semi-classical gravity, that knows about this difference? Like basically, what is the difference between the thermofield double states gravitational description, semi-classical gravitational description, as opposed to the evaporating black hole? And is there like a simple way to understand it? And turns out there is a simple thing you can look for. And the basic basic notion is that the geometry of the thermofield double looks like a Python. It's like each wormhole gets longer and longer as time passes. As opposed to the evaporating black hole, you have this big lunch that Python had in the middle. So there's like the geometry gets fatter and then gets smaller again. So the simplest way to understand this Python's lunch, actually, I should probably pause here and see if people have any questions. No questions? All right. Good. So, okay, to understand the Python's lunch, the best, the simplest model is tensor networks. So like things that are more precise that we studied is about tensor networks. And the example of Python lunch in the tensor network is the following. Let's start with like some number of qubits. This is like the input part. Each of these tensors legs are like unitaries going from left to the right. And then the network gets a bit fatter. So we add more qubits, like some ancillary qubits here, like in the red are included. And then the unitary dynamics continues. And then the network gets smaller, but it doesn't get as small as the initial size, but a bit bigger. So essentially the steps here are isometries that posts a leg on specific leg to being zero. So the whole network from the left to the right would be an isometry as well. Good. So this is a different, some tensor network, and this is a construct where I would like to call it has a Python slouch. So now let's think about like specifically why this thing has a high complexity. So suppose we start with an input state on initial qubits that's in psi in state, and then the dynamics will start including some ancillary state. Let's name it ML, be the number of the ancillary qubit. We start at the state zero. Then the network is composed a lot of unitary gates that's all together composed UTN, your big unitary. And the complexity of UTN will be, we'll call CTN, which is essentially like, for a scrambling unitary, it could be like log n times n or like polynomial in n. We haven't been too careful, but it's some kind of a sufficiently scrambling unitary overall. Then the last step that's the key is to shrink from this big part to the output state. And that shrinking happens with a pot selection on certain number of legs here. And then we'll get the output state. So the key is that if you have this kind of tensor network and you want to produce this final state only unitarily from initial state, meaning that you want to start out with the same initial state, psi in, and then ancillary qubits, all of them in zero, and only apply with a unitary that takes this state and the output is exactly the same as in the case of post-selection, can be potentially very hard. How hard? It's essentially, the idea is like you need to get rid of the post-selection step. And it's about how difficult is it to implement a post-selection process on MR qubits in the dynamics.
Can I ask a question here?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would like to understand, like, what is the operational meaning of this post-selection step? Because somehow this, like, yeah.
You mean in this specific network or?
Yeah, like something in the physical world, in black hole, just happens. And then what does it mean that you only accept for some outcomes? Like, it should always happen something. It's not like conditional. I don't understand.
Good. So in naive way, each of the Cauchy slices is a tensor network. That's like, you know, this is relying on the analogy between tensor networks and the Cauchy slices of space. So, however, I hope like by the end of the talk, it'll be more clear to you. This is just for now, I would say, just think about an example of a tensor network that has small size, small volume overall, meaning that it requires very few number of tensors. But if you try to think about the complexity, it actually has a large complexity if you try to implement everything on one side. But in terms of relating to physics, each of the networks is like, you can think about a Cauchy slice that's like building the tensor network. And then I will, for evaporating black hole, I'll explain how this comes about. How to detect this Python launch in the black hole scenario. But essentially, like, each of the gates is like building the space, essentially.
Thanks.
Okay, good. Thank you. Good. Oops, sorry. Wrong button. Okay. So the naive way to try to get rid of the post-selection step here is to keep running the circuit many, many times. And if this is a scrambling circuit, all of the possible outputs of the MR qubits in the end are equally likely. So to get all zero state, it will roughly take 2 to the MR trials. So if the network has CTN, like size, number of tensor in the networks, and then the roughly if you keep running it 2 to the MR time, you will get the right state. However, there's two problems with this. One is that it's actually non-unitary. You have to just keep running different unitaries until you hit the right answer. And we can do better than this. And we can do better by using a Grover-like search algorithm. So how it works? Suppose we have some input state phi that we act with a unitary UTN that has low complexity. And then we have an output psi out, and these are the post-selection qubits. So we could either get the post-selection to get psi out, or we can do the following. Let's define U phi to be this operator that flips the sign of all the other, all orthogonal vectors to phi, and multiplies phi with the one. And then let's define V, which does the same for the post-selected qubits, and then it time it rolls back and forward with the unitary. Then if we repeat the sequence U phi V L times, that's the square root of the 2 to the MR, we can actually extremely well approximate the output state. So this would say that the unitary way to implement post selection will be given by this unitary, where L will be 2 to the MR. So this is an algorithm that Kitaev and Yoshida used in their paper to turn like post selection into a unitary process. Like the construction is slightly different, but the algorithm is quite similar. Next, what we do, there's a subtlety that the input here, input state here, the construction UPL depends on the input state. So next we can actually get rid of that input state if we have input composed of two parts. One is like some arbitrary input state, and then we have access to this ancillary qubits ML. And with the assumption that ML is much larger than MR, we can define the unitaries U that flips the sign of the input only ancillary qubits appropriately, and we do the same thing on the output qubits. Then if we define a unitary UPL that's following the product of the tensor network and the repetition of this UV sequence, then this would do the job for any input state psi in. And this happens to be the case for the kind of networks we are studying, where we have both input and output, input auxiliary qubits, and we have output post-selection qubits. Good. I mean, this is formally this can be this is known by a robust oblivious amplitude amplification, and has been studied in this papers by Barry and Childs and then Gillian and collaborators. Good. So this tells me that the complexity in this way of getting rid of post-selection and actually doing everything with unitary gates, so the actual practical complexity of decoding on one side will be square root of the 2 to the MR, where MR is the number of post-selection legs. So naive question is, can we do better? So in the specific tensor networks where there is a lot of structure and or the network is not deep enough, there might be shortcuts, and we can't say anything about possibility of those. But if the network is scrambling, so it's sufficiently deep that it scrambles the initial information, and then it's very unlikely there would be a polynomial algorithm. So there would be polynomial in MR rather than exponential in MR qubits that would do the job. And there is no mathematical proof for this. However, if there was a polynomial shortcut that could find a better post-selection method for all possible networks that are scrambling, then this will result on this collapse of a polynomial class PP. That's a BQP is all the problems like quantum computer can solve in polynomial time. And then PP is if you allow post-selection. If you allow post-selection is post-BQP, which is equal, like by Scott Aronson showed, that it's equal to PP, which is believed to be a much bigger class than BQP. It contains NP. So it's highly unlikely there will be a general way to get rid of post-selection efficiently. So I think the fact that the complexity is exponential is highly likely in exponential in the number of post-selected legs. Good. Any questions at this point? All right. Move to the next one. So, okay, now I want to make a conjecture. And the conjecture is if you have a scrambling tensor network that gives an isometry from some small number of qubits to the large number of qubits from left to the right, and you want to find the complexity of producing the, like undoing this, reversing it, basically getting rid of the post-selection. So the complexity will be at least, I think we estimate, the exponent of the difference of the qubit numbers. And here the difference is like subtle for the general. In this network it's clear, but in the general networks, what we conjecture is that there are two minimas. Minima one is here and minima two is here. And you can reconstruct everything from the largest minima. So the largest minima will be n min number two. That's what we have, number of qubits. And then now we want to define the max. For general tensor networks, the definition of max that we propose, or like the method of computing the max, is following. Like, start slicing from left to the right with all possible ways, and left, right to the right. By fixing the endpoint, we're slicing the tensor network, and each slicing will have some maximal like cut. Then we minimize over these maximums. So we call it like a minimax procedure. So you pick a network, you like look at all possible slicings and find the slicing with the minimal maximum. And that's what that's what is like the N max, the definition of N max. And the conjecture we have is that the total complexity, restricted complexity on the largest part, larger minima, will be the size of the network and enhanced with the exponent of the difference of N max and N min. Two, which is like the medium size surface. Okay, good. So how would this appear in the gravity? So I think what we are expecting that in the gravitational setup, when you have high restricted complexity, the geometry will have a sort of Python's launch, meaning that it will have a min, max, min kind of surface. And this surface, I mean, in general, we have a proposal for how to do it covariantly, but with the naive naive understanding is that essentially, like the maximum, there's Cauchy, nice Cauchy slice that you can find, the special slice. And like if there is, like in the thermofield double, there is no bulge, the geometry are just a single minima. However, if there was a bulge, then you would say the complexity of doing everything on one side will be difficult because you have to bypass this bulge. And the enhancement of the complexity will be the area difference of the maximum and the largest minimum. Good. All right, now let's talk about more concretely about evaporating black hole and how this bulge can be detected in evaporating black holes. Yeah, any questions at this point? Good. Okay. So in the evaporation process, let's see, like B is some black hole and it has a wormhole, a one-sided wormhole. Like B can be formed from a collapse of matter. And then it keeps evaporating and Hawking modes are coming out. And this each of these modes are like entangling the outside mode is collected into some big pile called radiation, or we can call A. And then each time it's like a new mode comes out. Sort of as time goes, the wormhole gets longer. One way to see what this Cauchy slice is like, okay, so if we have an infalling matter that forms a black hole, it forms an event horizon, the blue one. And then the Cauchy slice that I was picturing here that like keeps adding new Hawking modes is this dashed line that like at the point when the black hole is just formed, the area is of the horizon is A0, is the initial size of the black hole. And like the line of the, like sort of marks the time, the dashed lines, as like more Hawking modes go out, the more like it is later and later in time. And the smallest is, if we are like detecting it at some time t, the smallest will be a horizon, which would be like after all the modes are gone, the horizon keeps shrinking. And this part all the way down will be essentially until like you reach an end, the wormhole kept shrinking until you hit the empty surface in the end of this. Okay, so this is just for the sake of illustration, like what the Hawking evaporation process looks like, but like all the notions we define can be done also covariantly.
Sorry, Harant. So is it a THD diagram or
what is it?
Is it a thermofield double diagram? Do you have two black?
No. I'm sorry. No, it's not thermofield double. It's a one-sided. It's infalling matter forms a black hole after this, but then you can extend the event horizon, right? Like before the matter failing.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right, and here is it's basically this is the wormhole. Each point is a sphere, and then here is like the empty surface, like the tip of the. Like the wormhole gets bigger and then shrinks up.
Oh, I see. Okay. So this is really a one-sided thing and R
equals. It's a one-sided pure state. Like you throw in matter, wait until it evaporates. I mean, there's a bit subtlety about like collecting this radiation, but you know, up to that subtlety where you take out the radiation, it looks like this essentially.
Thank
like
you.
Each time step gets longer. Yeah, for sure. Good. Okay. So this is the nice slice. I mean, this slice is just to make it like clear how to detect the Python lunch in this one. Okay. So let's start with the two minimums. The two minimums are like one cutting. So now that we have like space and also radiation modes coming out. So the full entanglement entropy in the bulk would be given by the area cuts and the bulk entanglement. And there are two minima of this generalized entropy. One is when we just cut the radiation. So it will be purely like a radiation degrees of freedom plus the empty surface here. And this would be let's call it the first minima. And then the second minima would be actually the cut that is only area term that comes from cutting right at the horizon of the black hole. And the transition, which one is the larger than the other, happens exactly at the page time. So S radiation equals H horizon over 4J for H bar G is the point where the second minima changes, right? Like, so initially the big minima is at the black hole. So everything can be reconstructed from the black hole side. As you cross the page time, everything can be reconstructed from the radiation at that point. And that's the definition of page time. Okay, maximal cut is much more. Okay, let me say one thing. So covariantly, these surfaces can be found by looking at the quantum extremal surfaces. Those are the surfaces that extremize the generalized entropy, and they are the minima. So, and the way to find this was done initially by Aaron Wall in 2012, and later, like in 2009, there was more like detailed prescription for the evaporation black hole by Akers, Engelhardt, and Pennington, and Usatsuk. And basically, what they propose is a maximin prescription, meaning that the way you find this minimal extremal surfaces is you look at, for each fixed Cauchy slice, you find the first and second minimal surfaces, and then you maximize over them. So the smallest one you find, and then maximize over all possible Cauchy slices. So that's why it's called maximin, meaning that you find the minimum cut in a specific Cauchy slice, and then maximize over all possible choices. And you know, they show that this gives you like a quantum extremal surface and the minimal quantum extremal surfaces. Okay, so this is like the technical way to find the sort of two ends of the Python's lunch. Now the tricky part is find the big part, the fat and the bulge in the middle, the size of the maximum. And the way you do it, the naive picture on this nice Cauchy slice that I drew, that the dashed lines of the independence diagram, if we look at that, so the way it works, so the first cut is just the radiation is the blue line. Then you will have a surface that cuts the radiation and cuts the wormhole at the A0, which is the largest area, and keeps moving forward. This we call like when you go from radiation side to the black hole end, to the horizon end, we call it the forward slicing. And then you can look at the slicing and then look at the maximum, and this would be the S radiation plus A0 over 4 H bar G, that's this cut. And the this is the with a, similar to tensor networks, you play the same game in terms of looking at all slicings and minimizing the maximum, right? Like we're thinking about all possible slicing, so we should look to another alternative slicing, and that slicing would be the reverse slicing, where we start from the black hole horizon and then move forward. So the cuts will involve one horizon cut and then another cut that cut radiation and wormhole and goes all the way back. And then we have to actually pick the minimum over all possible slicings. So depending what is the difference between like A0 and A horizon, there is a transition point where the max surface will jump from this one that adds the initial area to this one that adds two horizon areas. And that, let's call this time a half point. I want to emphasize that this point is a half time, like half time, basically is different from the page time, where page time was S radiation being H horizon, right? Good. So with this in mind, okay, I must say something like something here, that this calculation of actually explicitly finding this maxima of the bulge in evaporating black hole, we're only able to do it for the JT gravity plus free non-interacting fermions, like to find this like the maximal extremal surface. It is extremal surface, but it's non-minimal extremal surface. And the way you found it, yeah, we just basically like generalize this method of the wall minimax to actually do maxi minimax. Basically minimax here stands for like looking at the maxes of all slicings and finding the smallest. And then we maximize another time over all possible Cauchy slices. Okay. So this is a more of a conjecture, because we never proved that like this is like actually quantum extremal surface, but I think there's a lot of evidence for that, but we can't find this surface explicitly in JT gravity. Good. So this would be like the fat part of the Python's lunch for evaporating black hole. And then if you do that, like what I described specifically, you will find that it's the surface is the minima of this two, and it would be a different surface depending whether you're before or after the half time. Good. So with this description of mean, max, mean, like Python's lunch, and how to find each point of the Python's lunch, we are able to like use our conjecture here that the decoding complexity or restricted complexity from the largest subsystem, which is like actually at time zero, it's the black hole. And then after page time, it becomes the radiation, is given by the actual like spatial volume of this wormhole, which is like what like Lenny suggested, like the size of the wormhole itself, the volume of the wormhole, which is like the unrestricted complexity. Let's call it CTN. I guess I shouldn't use TN because it's not tensor network, but essentially this is the part that you get, which is like, I think in this scenario of evaporating black hole, it's just grows with time. It's like proportional to time, maybe with some factors in the front. But, and you have this exponential enhancement that comes from the difference of the generalized entropies at this max cut point that we defined appropriately, and the minimal point, like the second minima, like the largest minima, sorry. And this two we find with this maxi-min prescription and the other maxi-minimax prescription. So if you do that for the evaporating black hole and try to plot the complexity, you will get this behavior. So in the beginning, it would be growing exponentially. This is the log of complexity, and you divide with the initial entropy of the black hole when it was formed. And it will grow exponentially and saturate at some point. And in this region, you are like this is a restricted complexity to getting the information inside the black hole from the black hole side, because that's the largest mean is on the black hole side. And then there's a transition, then the minimal surface is switched, which one is larger, which one is smaller. And here you will have some linear growing part, because the generalized entropy will only come from the empty surface and the radiation. And then and the max will be given by the max that is the before half time, right? Like I was telling you, there's another transition of which is the maximal surface. And when that transition happens, that's in the half time, which is like a bit after like page time, the surface is switched, then the complexity starts decreasing again exponentially. So you have this window here when it's like very complex, like near the page time, to decode the information from the radiation itself. But then it starts getting easier and easier as like the modes come out, and you can just undo everything by undoing the dynamics of the black hole, meaning it will be polynomial. So I think this was kind of an interesting, like surprising thing, how there is like two transitions. Two different phase transitions, when the minimals switch, and when a new maximal surface comes in. Okay, so I hope at this point I convince you that there is a Python's lunch in the evaporating black hole, and how to find the min max min surfaces. But you know, confusing thing here, like for the evaporating black hole, because you have radiation contributions and you have the area contributions, so you have to like always like account for like generalized entropies when you're computing, looking at different Cauchy slices. So it's actually nicer to see other examples of black holes where you in fact do not, you have a Python's lunch without having having to worry about the bulk entanglement. So for example, if you have a pure state black hole that either is in the equilibrium and doesn't evaporate, or it's like very early on, like in the dynamics, so not sufficient amount of matter has evaporated, then the Cauchy slice or the wormhole like continues growing. And so if you pick a region A that's slightly more than the half and the complement being A bar, in this scenario, you have two minimal cuts that are purely area cuts, that are this and this guys. And then you have, Amanda, do you want to close? I'm sorry. And you have a wormhole that continues growing, and the maximal cut in this case will be a surface that goes into the wormhole and comes out. And so you maximize over all possible surfaces like this. And this will tell you that the operators inside the Python's lunch here, in this case, is like a single-sided black hole Python's lunch. You can construct from a larger side, but you might get a contribution to the complexity that's exponential in the area difference of the max cut and the min cut. And another example of the Python's lunch is actually present in empty ADS, where you have, again, region A. And region A bar. And there are two minimal surfaces, the orange one and the blue one. So in this case, like visually, the blue one is the larger one. And then there would be a maximal surface, which would cut A and A bar from each other. And that's like the dashed line. However, here is more tricky about thinking about complexity, because this network inside, the volume of the network inside, might actually not be scrambling enough to make the complexity very hard. And, these examples we just gave us just illustrations when there are like scenarios when this kind of mix min max min pattern appears in the generalized entropy and purely in the area form. And I think there's a lot of interesting things one could learn from these examples as well. Yeah, so, any other questions at this point?
Yes, here in the empty ADS case, your max surfaces are not smooth, right?
Good. Empty ADS one.
Because you have two dashed lines, but I mean, it's not clear to me if there are, I mean, how do you want to separate A and A bar, right? I mean, you go from one upper left to the middle and then go
to the middle. Yeah, you might actually want to have some smooth transition here, right? To have a fully.
And is it okay that we are not worried about time direction here somehow?
I think we haven't fully went into detail how to properly define here. I just wanted to give a, naive example of how would you see one. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to worry about the time direction. But I might be wrong. I haven't thought about it too much about this example. But I think it's possible to define it in a smooth way. Like when this dashed line, you only just extend basically blue and extend the orange one as maximal as you can, and then pick the minimal of the slicings essentially. You can basically think about the slicing from one side to the other. And then make sure the slicing is smooth, and then use this minimax to do it.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. But I was gonna say, these are examples that we just in our paper. If you look, it's just one section, just listing a bunch of interesting examples when Python launches appear. But what it means here really in terms of operator reconstruction, and we don't know much about it. Yeah, it sort of was a little outside of the scope of the paper, but I think it's interesting direction to also continue thinking.
Thank you.
Good. So just to quickly summarize, then I'll leave a few minutes for questions. So essentially, we're suggesting a new formula. We're conjecturing this formula that is quite convincing in the tensor networks. And if you believe in the analogy of tensor networks and ADS-CFT, then we generalize this to a geometric case when the restricted complexity of decoding information from some larger subregion will be given by this volume term that's action volume term that Eleni and friends have discussed, and multiplied with this exponent of the largest and second largest entropy difference. And in general, it'll be generalized entropy difference. And this is the naive intuition is that step going this, passing through the bulge will require a post-selection, and undoing this will be cost in terms of complexity. That's exponential in the difference of that. Yeah, so there are a few things I wanted to tell about the future direction. Some of them I'm myself thinking but then I'll be happy if other people find those questions interesting too. For example, actually study in depth this pure state black hole and empty ADS, where you have a reconstructum from subregion, and what does it tell about the dictionary from boundary to the bulk about for the operators that live in that subregion. Yeah, I think there's a lot more one can say about these things. And the other thing I was thinking about, the connection of this Python's launch to the other line of thinking about the holographic dictionary and the quantum extending Church-Turing thesis that recently there was a nice paper by Boland and Vazirani and also Lenny about the complexity of holographic dictionary and what exactly we mean by the dictionary, and can we define a dictionary restricted to a region, and in what cases reconstruction from boundary to the bulk can be difficult, and do you always have a Python's lunch? I think in a lot of examples I've thought that there's some notion of Python's lunch that you can observe. And just connecting these ideas, I think the paper came out during the time that the replica wormhole came out, and then there was the PETS map in the Stanford group's replica wormhole paper, and that's in principle how to reconstruct the island inside the black hole, but in principle it's one thing, in practice is the other thing, and just understanding the connection between the island region and this Python's lunch, and whether they are one-to-one correspondence or in different examples they are different concepts. Yeah, I think there might be interesting directions to work on this. Yep. Okay, I guess that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Hrant. We definitely have time for questions. So if anyone has a question, just go ahead and unmute and start asking.
I have a question. So you were motivated in part by finding a geometrical picture of the Harlow-Hayden argument.
That's right.
But in their argument, and especially as Aronson reformulated it, there's a post-quantum crypto assumption.
Mm-hmm.
The assumption that there are one-way functions that are secure against quantum attacks.
Right.
But the only complexity separation you spoke of was between post-BQP and BQP.
So
that seems like a milder assumption, but so how are these things related to one another?
Good. So because if post-BQP is equal BQP, right, then you can invert a one-way function.
Yeah, but I'm saying you're able to draw the conclusion about the complexity of decoding with, what on the face of it seems like a weaker assumption than they used.
Let's see. I mean, there are several differences, right? Like there's assumption about the dynamics, like that, you know, like Aronson's construction assumes that the dynamics is implementing this one-way function. Like here, we're assuming that if you were allowed to do arbitrary post-selection, like, I think we're actually doing a weaker assumption, no?
I thought you were just assuming a separation between BQP and post-BQP. What?
No, so what I'm saying, if you could, for arbitrary unitary, mm-hmm. like, if you could give an like Grover gives you exponential algorithm, right? What I'm saying is that if you could do for arbitrary unitary, like any unitary, you could do exponential speed up to the Grover, then that implies post BQP equals BQP. Right? Because doing for arbitrary unitary, getting rid of the post selection will imply that. Yeah, so that's the only thing I'm saying. For the so if you could give polynomial speed up in a post BQP case, you could also invert the one way function, and you can also it will also imply what Harlow and Hayden are assuming too, which is I think is the zero knowledge proof like become equal to BQP, I think.
So isn't the difference that here you assume that you probably don't have weird shortcuts, but I thought that they, Aronson and friends, basically what they're doing is they want to basically emphasize on that point and just exclude shortcuts with assumptions.
I think what they prove is technically relies on a much weaker assumption than what we do, right?
I think so.
They have like this specific encoding unitaries, and they say, oh, if you could like generally shortcut this unitary, then it will imply this complexity class collapse. We're saying if you can generally shortcut post-selection, if you could shortcut post-selection, then you could shortcut what they are doing as well. Yeah. I think like we didn't really think too much other than just, saying that, okay, like post-selection is hard. If it was easy in general, you would just have this crazy collapse of PP to BQP. Yeah, maybe like the connection between what Aronson does and what Harlow and Hayden do can be more clean better, but.
All right, so you claim I had it backwards. In fact, you're making a stronger assumption, which subsumes their assumption in both papers.
That's my understanding.
Knowledge and the post-quantum crypto and that maybe you didn't need to make such a strong assumption to draw the conclusion about the complexity of decoding, but at least to get your geometrical description of what's going on.
That's right. And I mean, they have weaker assumption, but the price they pay for it, they have stronger assumption about dynamics. Basically, it's either need to be the specific type of encoding unitary between radiation and black hole, or a one-way function implementation. And like for us, we're like stronger assumption, but for any unitary, you can do post-selection. Yeah, I think that's right.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for the question. Yeah. Any other questions, guys, about Pythons?
Any other questions? Okay, if not, then we can maybe unmute our mics and thank Grant for a nice talk.